The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thank you so much for being with me on this wonderful Thursday evening here in Bloomington, Indiana. As the students have arrived back in town, the gridlock is upon us, and it is fine. I always look forward to them coming. It creates an excitement and a buzz here in this community, and I love it when they leave, and then I have my summer to myself. So traffic is a little stiffer coming into the office in the morning. Of course, school has started, both Monroe County and RBB as well. So it's that time of year. Football season is right now on top of us. I can't wait for that to start with Indiana. Of course, we have the Colts already in full swing with preseason. And you guys all know Indiana basketball will be here before you know it as well. So a lot of great things to look forward to. And I cannot believe it's August and this weather has been the way it has been. But we're going to take it. All right, let's do a little news of the week brought to you by Kenny Bland Auctions. They're your full-service auction service. They want to be your person to go to when you're planning the sale of your estate or real estate. Visit them online at kennyblandauctions.com. I think they have weekly auctions, guys, so check them out. It's pretty cool. And Like Law Group, give yourself and your family the peace of mind that comes with proper estate planning. Long-standing supporter of the show, Lance at the Like Law Group, 812-323-8300. Now, you hear news things, right, about people getting their deeds stolen and their houses and all that. This is a crazy story about someone forging documents to take over the ownership of Graceland. Yes, Graceland, kind of reminding people to be leery of investment emails and unknown requests. So here's what happened. A Missouri woman, she was arrested on Friday morning, just this last Friday, and charged in connection with an attempted foreclosure scheme of Graceland. Yes, the former home of great music legend Elvis Presley, the United States Department of Justice said in a press release on Friday. Friday, interestingly enough, was also the anniversary of Presley's death. A lady by the name of Lisa Janine Finley, or Findlay, who the DOJ has said gone by many aliases over the past 30 years or something crazy like that. Criminal complaint charges against her with aggravated identity theft and mail fraud. Alleged complaint says the defendant orchestrated a scheme to conduct a fraudulent sale of Graceland. That is like beyond belief. Falsely claiming that Elvis, have you been to Graceland? It's pretty cool. Falsely claiming that Elvis Presley's daughter pledged the historic landmark as collateral for a loan that she failed to repay before her death. The statement continued, as part of this brazen scheme, we allege that the defendant created numerous false documents and sought to extort a settlement from the Presley family. Three foreclosure notices were published by Nasani Investments beginning on May 6, citing a public auction for the historic Memphis estate. On May 22nd, the foreclosure was halted by the Shelby County court hearing. Wow, that's crazy, right? But you hear about this stuff, and it's so rampant. My wife has Taylor Swift tickets for November. And, you know, nowadays, no one has real tickets. Now, I did get real football tickets for Indiana. I like that, paper tickets. I'm just old school like that. But it's pretty convenient when you want to sling tickets around. If I want to sling them to her and she wants to sling them to a friend, you know, day of games, you can sling them around just via the app. I love that. But they're at risk. So here she has this Ticketmaster account. And we get pink tickets. Pink's going to be at Lucas Oil Stadium. And they come to me, and I send them to her. I said, hey, I sent the pink tickets to you. Great, great. So she goes online to discover she has no Ticketmaster account. which, by the way, was holding 8 Taylor Swift tickets, and you guys know how valuable those are. So she contacts the fraud department at Ticketmaster because someone obviously had gone in, had her login information, stole the tickets, and then closed her account down. So she calls Ticketmaster 3 different times, all 3 times. She had to leave a message, never to get a call back. And then I'm monitoring, StubHub. And all of a sudden, her tickets pop up on StubHub. So I called StubHub and said, hey, these tickets are fraudulent. Well, can you tell us the account? No, I can't. I don't know. They got stolen. So dead end, right? Here are her Taylor Swift tickets, visibly on StubHub, stolen from Ticketmaster. Nobody knows. No one's calling her back. So if we finally get Lucas Oil involved, and they're working on it, trying to recover the tickets, and this has been going on now for like a month or longer than a month. I emailed them today, and they said, we're still working on it. Hopefully by the end of the day, Ticketmaster will be able to pull them back and get them back to your account. But that's how easy stuff can happen. Somehow they hacked in her Bonvoy account. Now, why is it her that always gets hacked? Probably because she's online about 50 times more than I am a day. I don't use a lot of online things. I'm just do my stuff at the office. That's about it. And we have a uber secure system at our office. So, yeah, but her Bonvoy points with Marriott got stolen. And she's getting emails about people trying to check in at a hotel. And I'm like, geez. So she's always changing her passwords. And I would suggest you do the same thing. I have LifeLock. I don't know a lot of you guys do. I'm not saying it's the best thing out there, but it seems to do a pretty good job of alerting me when things are going on. Mainly it's credit checks and things like that. But, you know, I'm like everybody else. My passwords are pretty much the same across the board because I don't know how to remember 50 different passwords, or I don't want to carry around something. I think you can do that now in an app, but again, I don't really dig that too much. So it's always what? People's dogs, their kids, right? All that kind of stuff. And I'm no different. And it's very, very common. I'm sure that people get their stuff hacked and stolen. And here it is. Graceland, of all things, was attempted to be hijacked and sold at auction to repay a fake debt. And by the way, when I was looking at this, they forged signatures. They had notaries, fake notaries, all kinds of stuff, and it was on its way out the door. So just be careful. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, do you guys listen to David McKnight much? I mean, of course, I've had him on the show a few times, Power Zero guy. I know there's a lot of cross-pollination between my stuff and his stuff. He does a podcast just about every week. I get the notification. I listen to some of them. Sometimes I don't. But he had one recently that I just thought would be perfect to talk about, and it's called The Guru Gap, Exposing Flaws in Popular Financial Advice. Now, he has a brand new book called The Guru Gap. You can actually pre-order it on Amazon, and I think you can even get it for free by using ID. Now, this was an email I had, so you can try it. Order ID, and you just type in davidmcknight.com, and I think it's either really cheap or even free, the Guru Gap. I'll talk about that when we come back at Your Money with David Hayes. Everybody's a guru at something, right? I was introduced to someone recently. Oh, by the way, I think I may have talked about this, but I've only taken an Uber 2 times in this town, and it's for weird reasons, right? I had to get from where I dropped my car off to get a tire fix home because I didn't want to bother anyone at work, and I didn't, you know, it's just easier. And I rented a car from my niece because her car broke down and I had to return the car last Friday, and it was just more convenient to get an Uber and go home. But, you know, I just don't do Ubers in Bloomington because, like, I rarely need to do that. And but what's fun is that both of my Uber drivers were listeners of the show. And I said, man, I appreciate you guys listening. He goes, I really enjoy it a lot. And I thought, well, I guess if you're in the car all the time, you're listening to something. So I guess you're going to listen to me. So I appreciate that very, very much. But that's not where I was headed with that. I did tell someone recently, yeah, I'm the retirement guru. And I thought, well, that's kind of pretentious, so I don't know. But everyone's a guru at something, they claim. David McKnight, the best-selling author of The Power of Zero and some other things as well, has written a new book called The Guru Gap, Exposing Flaws in Popular Financial Advice. So I'm going to talk about this just for a minute, because he takes some people to the mat on a few things, including some of the most notable people, notable names like Susie, Dave, Ken. You know who I'm talking about. And I'm just going to back up and say, I agree. I totally agree. Because when you're listening to these guys, they use such blanket statements. And I hate blanket statements, like only buy term insurance. I hate annuities, or a certain mix of mutual funds, average 8 to 12%, and you can take out that from your investments and live on it in retirement. Blank statements aren't the way to manage risks, emotions, money, or your life. Even me, myself, and I will tell you that I believe taxes will be and must be higher in the future than they are today. Now, that might seem like a blanket statement to you. But if you've listened to me enough or read my book, especially 2025, The Final Drive, you'll understand that I talk about all types of different taxes that could be created or could go up to pay for all the things that we have promised and will continue to spend money on or support or whatever it might be. Like a national sales tax, right? Is that possible? Sure, anything's possible. What about more usage taxes? You know, we pay taxes to use our cell phones, usage taxes for, you know, a lot of different things, right? Sin taxes, right? And that could be not just tobacco and alcohol, but it could be sugary drinks. That's been tried before. Gas tax, tax on Social Security, Medicare taxes, capital gain taxes. Oh, and yes, income taxes. But my point has always been, this is not a blanket statement that tax rates are going up and you have to do a Roth conversion. My point has always been, that's the only thing I can control. I can't control all these other things, gas tax, usage taxes, sales taxes. I can't control if they decide to start taxing Social Security fully, or Medicare taxes go up, or they change the capital gains rules and you have no more carry forward of stepped up basis at death, which I think is going to happen at some point. But I can control the taxes on my retirement accounts right now. And when I say right now, I'm saying, hey, I'm in the 24% bracket all the way up to taxable income that's in the low 300s. And you're telling me that I can move money from taxable to tax-free and only pay 24% or 22% or 12% or 10%, right? And never pay it again? That's just federal. You pay state also. So I hate blanket statements. When do you buy term insurance? When you need to cover something for a specific term, right? Educating your kids, paying your house off, completing a plan. Like if I died too early and I was being the one most relied upon to have a great retirement, yes, I need it for that. But when do you need permanent insurance? Maybe it's for long-term care. Maybe it's to pay some federal estate taxes down the road. Maybe it's to do a buy-sell arrangement on your business. There are so many reasons that you could and should buy permanent insurance. I hate annuities. What are you talking about? You hate annuities. That's just a silly blanket term. There's fixed index. There's registered linked index annuities that no one complains about, by the way, because they love them. They're short-term. They give you participation in the market that sometimes it's over 100%. I've talked about it here on the show, with downside protection and no fees. You have variable annuities that you can take money out and invest it in mutual fund-like subaccounts, and it may have a protection of income or death benefit, right? There's all kinds of different annuities. Why would you just say, I hate annuities? That's like saying, I hate stocks, right? Well, I hate bad stocks. I'd hate the ones that go down. We all do that. But I hate stocks. I hate bonds. I hate real estate. I hate annuities. I hate blanket statements. And by the way, average returns in retirement do not matter. They don't matter. Average returns are fine when you're in the accumulation stage, but when you're in the distribution phase, it's how your returns come that matter. If something averages 8 to 12%, which I don't disagree that could be true over a 30-year period of time, but you also go through periods of time where you have negative, negative, negative. Let's go back to 2000, 2001, 2002. And by the way, I'm pulling money out of my retirement account. Even if the, over time that negative didn't really matter and it still averaged 8 to 12, it's the sequence, when the returns come, how they come, that's what matters. Average returns don't matter. So I'll get off my high horse, but I think it's kind of nice that David McKnight, who has a national platform, is taking on the guru and saying, listen, there's some flaws here in your popular financial advice and using blanket terms like I just mentioned earlier. That is really misleading and probably, you know, should be called out. So thank you, Dave, for that. All right, let me take a break. We're going to come back, get Hot Rod on the phone. It's been a crazy, crazy like week and a half because we had 8 straight days up. We have 1 day down. We have the Fed over at Jackson Hole. We had employment numbers that got adjusted I've never even seen this happen before where they go back and say, oh, sorry about that. We actually created 800,000 less jobs in the past year than what we thought. Who's accountable for that, right? And we've been leading our financial economic policies based on employment and inflation and the numbers are all wrong. It goes back to saying they always get it wrong, right? I'm going to take a break. Come back. We'll get Hot Rod on the phone. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It's Your Money with David Hayes. I'm going to talk a little bit about last week first, and we have Hot Rod on the line to talk about the craziness of this week, and it is crazy, and we're going to talk about the jobs revision when I get Rod on here in just a second. But let's talk about last week. Stocks posted solid gains last week, buoyed by robust economic data and constructive comments from the Fed as well. So the S&P was up almost 4%, the NASDAQ up over 5%, and the Dow, it lagged a little bit, but still picked up nearly 3%. Three critical economic data points gave investors what they were looking for: wholesale inflation, consumer prices, and retail sales. Both the producer price index and consumer price index rose less than expected in July, reinforcing a picture of cooling inflation. The July retail sales report on Thursday was stronger than expected, which added more fuel to the fire or the week-long rally. The market action slowed on the week's final trading day, Friday, with positive consumer sentiment gains countered only by a drop in housing starts. But then we've got another report that just came out on existing home sales. We're going to talk about that in just a second. It was the S&P 500's best weekly gain of the year so far and the best since November of 2023. The gains helped erase losses from earlier in the month when carry trades, as they call them, and news from Japan, the black whatever it was at Japan, unsettled the markets. So then last week's market rally saw kind of an assist from Caitlin Clark. No, not that. Rod and I talked about that this week too. But from two places, economic data and constructive Fed comments. On Thursday, Atlanta Fed president said he had a lot more confidence that inflation was sustainably on its way to 2%, citing steady drops in the CPI. St. Louis Fed said the time may be nearing when adjustments to the Fed's fund rate will be appropriate. So, Rod, here we are this week. Jackson Hole, we'll have Fed comments tomorrow. But I do want to talk about, you know, when we talk about CPI numbers, we talk about GDP, and we talk about, you know, information coming out of the Congressional Budget Office. Man, what a miss on this employment thing. You know, Glass kind of caught me off guard. He asked me about it on Wednesday, and I'm like, I haven't even talked to Rod. I haven't really paid attention to the data today. But let's talk about that just for a minute, because I think it's important for people to understand that a lot of the Fed policy has been based on these jobs numbers, have been based on CPI. And you kind of get to the point like, can I even believe anything that comes out of the government data?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, a big part of what the Fed kept talking about as inflation was moving in the right direction was that their fear, if they started to cut rates too soon, with such a strong labor market, that would just refan the flames of inflation and they would pick back up. And lo and behold, we find out that, hey, maybe the jobs market wasn't anywhere near as strong as what had been reported. Yeah, that's a huge miss, 818,000 jobs in a year. This was a March over March, going back in and digging into the numbers. And that equates to something like 66 or 68,000 monthly average decrease on that job. Well, when you go back and you look at that average, the average jobs number, I think, had been running at around 220. You knock 66, 68,000 off of that. You're now actually showing a labor market that is basically just barely replacing the jobs that are lost due to retirement, death, and disability. That's not jobs growth. I mean, that run rate, the burn rate, I mean, it's around 150,000. I haven't heard it lately. But you're probably still around 150 to 175 on the high end. And that's just replacing those people that retire, that die while still working, or have a disability kick in while still working and have to leave the workforce for that. So, yeah, that paints a completely different picture. Rather than adding jobs consistently and real job growth every single month from March to March, you actually were basically just maintaining what you had in that. And the only thing I would say from the Fed's perspective, there are other data providers out there, none that get as much acknowledgement as what the monthly jobs number from the government gets. The more accurate one is actually, and this is kind of where the data came from, is there's a quarterly one on the employment and payroll survey that's done. And I think the article I read says that basically around 95% of it's covered, of payroll is covered by them. So it's a much more accurate number, but they take a lot more time in gathering the data, and it only comes out every 3 months. So I know financial institutions had a good idea that there was a revision coming. I think they suspected it was going to be a little bit large. I don't know that anyone anticipated it would be this big. So I have to assume the Fed had a decent idea. But yeah, to your point, Dave, it paints a completely different picture as to where the job market has been. And if that was a big driving force behind the Fed choosing to not decrease rates because of how strong the labor market was, well, they got to apparently go back and rethink and have a different discussion about that now that we know that jobs were dramatically overstated.
So, I'm boots on the ground, seeing people all the time, and it kind of makes you think, well, this is why maybe people don't trust the markets, because, you know, the Dow's at 40,000, the S&P's been way up. It was then down, now it's back up to almost where it was. The NASDAQ peaked, I think, back in early July, around 1860 or 18,600-ish, and now it's sitting around, 17,009. That's up there. And I know a lot of people are like, okay, well, if this was all driven by the data, including the jobs number, I would have thought that that shock and awe of that jobs number would have had a bigger effect on the market.
Well, and I think one reason it didn't is while the market has most certainly appeared to be signaling it is interested in good news actually being good news and bad news actually being bad news, I think the only reason it kind of brushed this off was the market has priced in a rate cut in September. And I think that this only solidifies that the opportunity to start cutting rates probably does begin for the Fed in September. And I think the other thing behind it is I don't know that the market moves a lot based off of any government data points. And I think the market looks at other sources, because the government data points, one, you can claim from a conspiracy perspective or whatever that they're manipulated, that they put inputs in that give them the outputs they want, because the government jobs number does make some guesstimates to come up with their numbers. Mm-hmm. And obviously they guess poorly. Now, really bad when you miss it that bad along the way. So there is some problems with the way they collect that data and everything. I just don't know that the market itself looks at the government to be an efficient,
reliable,
transparent, honest, reliable source for data, and they're going to look at it in other places. They're going to look at it in quarterly earnings statements and what CEOs and CFOs have to say. They're going to look at it at the banks, from the bank's perspective. Are small businesses borrowing? Are small businesses paying their loan payments? Is the consumer making their payments? Is the consumer borrowing to buy automobiles, to repair or fix up their house, or to buy new houses? Those are the types of things that I think really mean something to the government, to the market. Now, it doesn't ignore those government numbers, because it does know that the Fed is looking at them and that the Fed will take some action based off of that. But as I said, surely the Fed is smart enough to know, although they are also a bureaucratic entity, that there are multiple other sources and potentially some better sources that they should be looking at as opposed to just purely government data.
Real quick before I let you go, with the fact that everything's pretty high, we have had people say, you know what, I don't know that I want to continue to take on this risk, because they felt a little bit of a shock not long ago, and now they're kind of getting back to where they were, which is, you know, the way things work. We continue to promote the idea, you're right, of having liquidity, having a protected piece, and then having your full on. Liquidity might be, you know, short bonds, money market, things like that to go to when you need the money pretty soon. A protected piece, and what I mean by that, I'll tell you, the market's been extremely, extremely robust in rolling out these buffer exchange-traded funds. Folks, if you haven't heard about these or you haven't even considered them, Rob, they're pretty slick, and they keep coming out more and more and more. And we've been on them now, what, for 4 years, I think, when they first came out, 3 or 4 years ago when they first came out?
Yeah, it's been at least that, because we did watch them for about a year to see if they acted like we thought they would act, and they did. And, yeah, we had used them, because the great thing about it, you know, what is used to build them, we have fully understood and could build them ourselves for our clients. The problem is it takes an enormous amount of money to build that into a client's portfolio on an individual basis, and going out and actually buying and selling the calls and buying and selling the puts to give you that downside protection and cap that upside as the trade-off for giving you some downside protection. So to be able to wrap it up into a product like an ETF and be able to deliver that to the retail world in masses at a very low entry level, yeah, it's great that they're bringing these products out. It makes it a lot easier. They also have the ability, when they're going to the market with huge volume, they can get their strikes and expiration exactly where they want them, versus if we were building it for an individual's portfolio, we would have to just go with the strikes and expirations that are available to us. And they may not be at the exact optimal place that we would like to see them, but a packaged product with millions of dollars and potentially billions of dollars, they can go to the option market and say, hey, here's exactly where we want this strike on the S&P 500 or the triple Qs or the Russell 2000. Those are the three major indices that they're being done on. There are a few others that are being created out there. But, yeah, from the standpoint of generating income to 10% downside protection to 25 or 30% downside protection, all the way to even now 100% downside protection, and varying degrees of when these things expire or roll. Quarterly ones, yearly ones. I know the first 100% downside ones that were coming out were 2-year products. You don't have to keep them for that whole time, but that's just when the options expire, and they would be buying and selling brand new options to reset that cap. The downside protection is always the same on those products. It's just a matter of where the cap is set, and it's based on where the market is at the point in time that those options are bought and sold.
What I like about these products is that you can get in and out of them. So, like, for instance, let's say you had a cap of 12 and you're already at 10, and your annual renewal, whatever you want to call it, is maybe, you know, in December. You could say, heck, I'm going to go ahead and sell it now, even though it's, you know, just approaching September. I'll take my gain and I'll go reset my protection again. And that, so you can actively manage your downside by doing that. And again, you do limit your upside, but that's okay for a portion of the portfolio. But I'm just telling you, folks, we're not telling you everything you need to know about these, but just know that they're available. If you have an advisor, talk to them about it. If you want to talk to us about it, feel free to contact us. We'd be happy to share information about how these things work. CFCI.us, contact us. It'll eventually make its way to Jim Emmon Jr., and then somehow, some way, it makes it over to me or Rod or whoever needs to answer the question. So, Rob, we'll let you go. Of course, we'll hear you tomorrow on Big Show Friday. A lot of stuff to talk about with you and Glass.
All right, sounds good, Dave. Have a great show.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, is gold the inverse of confidence? Just a little history lesson on gold as well. We'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. You know, everyone always asks, should I own gold? Well, you know what? It's probably okay. I mean, I think owning is good. You know, I've bought and sold gold over my years. You know, I probably should have not sold it in the most recent run, but, you know, you just have to kind of follow things. And, you know, gold kind of follows confidence. And when confidence is kind of swaying, gold will tend to do well. And then you also have to compare it to the weakness and strength of the underlying currency that you are part of, like the U.S. dollar. And, you know, back in the day, as we all know, the dollar used to be on the gold standard. You know, the British stopped using the gold standard around 1931. The U.S. followed suit in 1933 and finally abandoning all remnants of the system under the Nixon administration in 1973 when I was 3 years old. And then we went to this thing called the fiat system, and it's a monetary system which values the currency not based on any physical commodity, but instead it allows it to fluctuate dynamically against other currencies on a foreign exchange. So the term fiat is a Latin term, and the meaning is basically an arbitrary act or decree. So the value of a fiat currency is ultimately based on the fact that they are defined as legal tender by the way of a government decree. You might remember back in 1933, FDR made an emergency statement, foresaw one of the most crazy events in the U.S. financial history in the Emergency Banking Act, which forced all Americans to convert their gold, coins, bullion, and certificates into U.S. dollars. In 1934, the president signed the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, which transferred the title of gold from private owners to the U.S. Treasury. Now, you know, I wasn't around in 1933. I'm sure that really worried people that they were getting some rights taken away. The gold bug still clings to the past, and I think it's, you know, it's kind of just ingrained in us as Americans. Like, we want to own something, you know, like that. But it's been on an incredible run, and you know why? Well, one, inflation. You know, I told you early on, buy things that go up with inflation. Well, gold has historically gone up with inflation. Stocks go up with inflation. You know, owning things go up with inflation over time, and gold's no different. Now, I will tell you that people are always like, how should I own the gold? Well, I spent some good time with Julian on the phone from First Eagle Global, who probably has the biggest stash of gold, and just hearing how they store it, where they store it, and how when you trade it, they take it from one vault over to another vault, and it's really interesting. But the how do you, and then of course you're owning it through something, through a vehicle, like through an exchange traded fund, through a fund. And then you're always like, well, how can I trust that, right? Well, I think you can, because, you know, they have to do court reports, and they have to be checked, and they have to be counted, and they have to be inventory. I think so. But I know a lot of people like to have the physical thing in their hand, and that's okay too. People want to own it in their IRAs. You can do that. You just have to know how and where to do that. Just like owning real estate. You can own real estate in an IRA as well. In your Roth IRA, it has to have annual valuations. You still have to have that 8606 that gets reported, all kinds of things, right? It's the same rules that follow whatever investment that you have in whatever vehicle that you have it in. But right now, Dave Hayes does not currently own gold in any way, shape, or form. Like I said, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. I'm just saying that this is kind of a history lesson of sorts on gold. And the gold is maybe the inverse of confidence. All right, let me take a quick break. When I come back, let's see. I'm going to talk about, so this article came up, let me find it, in Think Advisor. And it was quoting my buddy Ed Slott about why a lump sum beats an IRA rollover for some people. And so I started reading the article, and I just thought there were a couple nuggets in here, going back to the gold analogy, a couple of nuggets in here I thought I should revisit with you, because sometimes it's better to do a lump sum distribution in some way, shape, or form than an IRA rollover. And I talked about this specifically, I think, a couple weeks ago, so it will be a refresher for those of you that are junkies of the show. All right, I'll be right back. It's Your Money with David Hayes. I didn't talk about this with Hot Rod, but U.S. existing home sales did rise more than expected in July. You know, we've had a little bit of a tick down in interest rates, which makes mortgage rates a little more favorable. But also, it's the season, right? I mean, who wants to buy and move in December or January or February, at least here in this area of the country? let's get it when the kids are out of school. Let's move around. Let's do our downsizing, upgradings, whatever it is that you want to do. And so it's pretty common that that time of the year, this time of the year, would have a pretty decent number of existing home sales. Yeah, so it came out on August 22nd. All right, so I see this article from thinkadvisor.com. Ed Slott, of course, then my ears and eyes perk up. Why a lump sum beats an IRA rollover for some. And I'm like, okay, I got to read this. Well, it wasn't a very well-written article, to be quite honest. And you know, I've been quoted in publications, and I've been interviewed by lots of different journalists, and most of them are freelancers, and they get a opportunity to write an article. You know, I remember one. She was 32 years old. I could hear her toddler in the background. I heard the dog barking. She's working from home. And she didn't really know much about what she was asking me about. So she really relied on me to provide the content, and then she put the narrative around it. So that's kind of where you hit. Now, there are some business writers, like some really good, solid business writers. Now, a lot of them will write for like the Wall Street Journal or real big publications, maybe Forbes or something like that. But generally, these are all freelancers. So I dig into it, and it's like, while an IRA rollover is the best move for most people when distributing money from a 401k plan, there is a special case when a lump sum distribution would make more sense. Now, I'm like, okay, I was trying to think, when would that make the most sense? Pulling it out of an IRA. Well, it would mean I'm trying to do some asset protection, because, you know, a lot of times if you want to protect your assets from, let's say, Medicaid, it's kind of hard with an IRA, because where are you going to stick it? I've got to take it out, pay the cash, and then stick it into maybe an irrevocable trust or whatever. So I'm like, okay, that's about the main reason I can think of. So we had some new Labor Department rules, a new fiduciary rule come out not long ago. And they're basically trying to prevent people from making knee-jerk default to an IRA rollover. So Ed went on to say, the Labor Department wants advisors, financial advisors, to get educated on each option of an old 401k and have to process in place and have a process in place to explain the best of three options for distributing assets. Roll it to an IRA, leave it in the company plan, roll it to a new plan, or take a lump sum distribution and pay the tax. Now, why would you leave it in the company plan? Generally, that's not the best option, but I can think of one. Let's say that you are 55 and or older, and you terminate service from a company. Well, you can access money from that 401k plan with no penalty. It's called the Rule of 55. That may be a good reason to leave it there. Now, what would be a good reason to roll it over? Just about anything else. We have this rule called the age-based in-service distribution rule, which says at 59 and a half, the IRS says you can roll money out of a 401k that you're actively in, a 403b that you're actively participating into an IRA. Why would you want to do that? Well, I call it the get ready to get ready rule. It's almost 60. I may be retiring in the next 5 to 10 years. I want to get money out of the vehicle that's really meant to accumulate, not to distribute money, and get it into a place where I'm getting it teed up to be able to pull income from. Everybody in this town pretty much has that. School systems have it. You know, all of the utility companies have it where you can get money out. Cook has it. Everyone has it. Catalan has it. Everybody has the rule built in their plan. Now, it doesn't mean that the plan has to allow it. Like a plan does not have to allow loans either. But it is allowed by the IRS. Whether your plan allows it or not, I don't know, but almost every plan does. So let's talk about the lump sum. Where he was headed with this is sometimes it makes sense to do a lump sum. Now, the article leans towards taking it out and paying the tax. I'm no. It's when you have company stock in your plan. You should do a full distribution. The stock comes out as a lump sum, not to the IRA. The remaining money goes into the IRA. Remember, that stock, when you pull it out in that capacity, you're only going to pay the tax on the cost basis, not the value. So let's say you work for a big company, and every big company, everyone has stock from that company in their plan, unless you divest from it. And let's say you've been working there for 30 years, and it's worth $1 million. and maybe your cost basis is only $100,000. You can take it out, pay tax on $100,000. The other $900,000 would be treated as long-term capital gains, much more favorable than ordinary income tax. But the way this article was written, it made it seem like you had to take it all out, pay the tax on the money. You don't have to. You can roll that part to an IRA and pay the capital gain or pay the income tax on the stock. But it kind of, didn't do a great job of explaining that. So hopefully people didn't read this thinkadvisor.com and think that that's what they should do. Generally, it's best to roll it into an IRA, but not always. Smaller balances, I'm like, just move it to the other plan, to your new plan. That's usually the best thing to do. But don't do the old take the money and run option. That should be marked out with skull and crossbones. I don't like to ever do that. And the other sad part is sometimes when you have really small balances, like you have a $2,500 balance, the plan may say, if you don't do anything with this, we're going to distribute it to you. Well, that stinks, because if I'm 40 years old and all of a sudden I get a check in the mail, yeah, I'm paying tax on it. I have a 10% penalty on it. So if you've left a job, you may want to check the rules to make sure that you either don't have to do anything or that you need to do something. All right, let me take a quick break. Come back. We'll wrap up this show. It's Your Money with David Hayes. All right, everybody. Once again, I hope you're enjoying this unusually cool weather. It's really nice. I mean, I was out the other evening and I thought, oh man, I need a jacket. My wife and I and my son and one of his good buddies, we had decided to have Mexican together on Wednesday night of this week. And my wife's like, let's sit outside. I'm like, okay. Well, it was wonderful. The sun was up. And then when the sun went down, I'm like, ooh, it's cold out here. So yeah, so it's hard to believe in August that you would complain about it being a little chilly at night, but it's been great. It's been great. So a lot of fun things happening. If you missed any of the show, of course, you can catch it on Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. here on WGCL 98.7 FM. And, of course, it goes up online tonight after the Thursday night listening time. And then once it gets online, it shows up on your favorite podcast, wherever you get those. And if you're not listening on the podcast, a lot of people do. You can go and download Your Money with David Hayes, and I have a lot of content, many, many years now of built-up shows, and that's why we're getting so many listens, because the more content you put out, the more listeners you get, and the more it floats up to the top when you type in, podcasts for money or retirement or whatever. So it's usually up there in the top somewhere, so you'll find it for sure. So what do we have this weekend? Well, let's think. I have a lot going on this weekend. So we have Ducks Unlimited Banquet, which we have a table. That's a conservancy program for wetlands, and I'm not a big duck hunter or anything, but certainly support that. My son's somewhat involved. Let's see. Sunday afternoon, they have the Little League Jamboree, which I believe is at Memorial Stadium. It usually is, and I'll be out there for that as well. Friday night, what's going on Friday night? I have to be up at Greenwood on Friday night. Busy weekend as always, and I'll be teed up and ready to come back next week. So I hope everyone else has a great weekend, and I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.